Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, in the final quarter of 2023, after-tax corporate profits reached an all-time high, $2.8 trillion. As reported by Popular Information, corporate profit margins were at a level not seen since the 1950s, as increases in prices have outpaced increases in costs, which Capitalism 101 says shouldn't happen, because competing companies are supposed to step in and offer lower prices and grab some of that market share, right? So what's different now? Well, abject greed, abetted by policy and whistled past by the press corps. As one economist put it, quote, if people are paying $3 for a dozen eggs last week, they'll pay $3 this week, and firms take advantage of that, close quote. Well, one reason we have details on greedflation is the work of the Groundwork Collaborative. We spoke with their economist and managing director of policy and research, Rakin Mahboud, a few months back, and we'll hear some of that conversation again today. Also on the show, while much else is happening, we can't lose sight of the ongoing assault on reproductive freedom, also known as basic human rights, being given tailwind by the Supreme Court. Advocates long warned that overturning Roe versus Wade would not be the end, and it wasn't. The court is now entertaining challenge to the legality of the abortion medication mifepristone, used safely and effectively for decades now, including invoking the 1873 Comstock Act about sending obscene materials through the mail. The Washington Post described it all as a confusing legal battle, but Counterspin got clarity from the Guttmacher Institute's Rachel K. Jones last year, and we'll hear some of that today as well. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. NBC created a stir when it announced the hire of former RNC chair Ronna McDaniel as an on-air political analyst. After vocal pushback from employees across the company's outlets, they reversed that decision. That was a positive course correction, but as Julie Holler writes for Fair.org, the story is an inauspicious sign for how corporate media will deal with Donald Trump in the 2024 election. McDaniel supported Trump's false 2020 election claims and frequently attacked the legitimacy of the press corps, including NBC and MSNBC journalists. But being anti-journalism and anti-democracy apparently didn't bother NBC's leadership. It couldn't be a more important moment to have a voice like Ronna's on the team, said a senior VP in the internal hire announcement. So while it's heartening that the pushback from NBC journalists forced management's reversal, it sounds as though the decision was more about quelling that workplace rebellion than recognizing the baseline journalistic standard of not rewarding liars with airtime. The coverage also showcased a problem. The Washington Post said the outrage over the hire is, quote, indicative of the larger struggle television networks have faced in hiring pundits to offer a pro-Trump perspective without running afoul of both the audience and their own employees, close quote. The New York Times said it, quote, underscored the deeply partisan sphere in which news organizations are trying to operate and the challenge of fairly representing conservative and pro-Trump viewpoints in their coverage, close quote. Politico talked about the dilemma of how to responsibly represent voices from the Trump right without handing platforms over to election deniers or bad faith actors who have attacked and attempted to discredit reporters. This is not a legitimate dilemma that news outlets could somehow overcome, because Trumpism is founded on the rejection of truth and honesty. But as Trump creeps back closer to power, corporate media are likewise slinking back to hedging their bets and prioritizing false balance over actual journalism. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Months ago, when folks were expressing shock at high grocery prices, we were told it was inflation or supply chain shocks due to the pandemic. Now, prices are still high, and corporate media seem less interested in explaining why that is. Rakeen Mahboud is chief economist and managing director of policy and research at Groundwork Collaborative. Back in February, we asked her to help explain what's going on.
My colleagues at the Groundwork Collaborative, Liz Pancotti, Bharat Ramamurthy, and Claire Wilson, recently authored a report that really digs into what's going on with grocery prices. And what they find is that while grocery price increases have outpaced overall inflation, and families are now paying 25% more for groceries than they were prior to the pandemic, compared to 19% of overall inflation, right? So there's this gap between what folks are paying at the till and what inflation would suggest. And this is particularly hitting folks who are on the lower incomes and the income distribution harder. In 2022, people in the bottom quintile of the income spectrum spent 25% of their income on groceries, while those in the highest quintile spent just under 3.5%.
Wow.
And this is a trend that we see across the board with essentials. Because something is essential, you have to buy it. If you earn less money, a bigger proportion of your income is going to go towards those essentials. And so that means that when you see inflation and, frankly, corporate profiteering, which I'll get into in a second, showing up in spaces for essential goods, it's always the people who are most vulnerable who are hit the hardest. It's wonderful that you're really focusing in on groceries. And, you know, I think one thing to note, just to zoom out a little bit from grocery prices in particular, is that an underexplored topic still, I think, in the discussions around inflation is the role of corporate profit margins. Because the fact remains that corporate profit margins have remained high and even grown, even as labor costs have stabilized, input costs, so the costs of things that are used to produce goods, have come down, and supply chain snarls have started to ease. And in a different paper by two other of my colleagues, Lindsay Owens and Liz Pancotti, they find that from April to September of 2023, so that's very recently, corporate profits drove 53% of inflation. When you compare that to the 40 years prior to the pandemic, profits drove 11% of price growth. There are a lot of explanations out there of what's causing inflation, but it's very important to focus on the role of big companies using the cover of inflation to jack up prices. And they continue to do that even as their own costs are coming down.
Well, and I want to say you can illustrate that point with just data, as these works from Groundwork Collaborative do. But at the same time, you also have, you know, as the kids say, receipts. In other words, earnings calls where CEOs are saying it out loud, their situation in terms of supply chain, in terms of COVID and whatever, they're using that as an opportunity to keep prices high.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk about another essential good, which is diapers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think diapers are really a good example because it sort of illustrates what's going on right now and ties together the idea of corporate profiteering, but also this idea that its scholars Isabella Weber and Evan Wasner put out there about tacit collusion and implicit collusion. So let's unpack that. What does that all mean? So what they write about is that inflationary environment, so when prices are rising across the board, it means that companies, especially those that are in really concentrated markets, can raise their prices precisely because they know that their competitor is going to do the exact same thing, right? So if you are one of three big companies and you know that your competitors are also going to raise prices, there's no reason for you not to raise prices. And that logic also applies in the reverse. So when costs are coming down, if you know that your competitors are going to keep their prices high, you're also going to keep your prices high, right? Which is, I think, why we're seeing, even as input costs come down, prices are staying high and people are still paying more than they should be given the cost of input. So diapers, right? Diapers, I think, is the perfect example for this. It's a super, super concentrated market. Procter & Gamble and Kimberly-Clark control about 70% of the domestic market. and diaper prices have increased by more than 30% since 2019, from about $16-$17 to nearly $22. And so the main thing that goes into producing diapers is wood pulp. It's also the main input into, you know, toilet paper, paper towels, basically paper products that we use around the house. The wholesale wood pulp prices really skyrocketed by 87% between January 2021 and January 2023. But in 2023, like between January and December of 2023, prices declined by 25%, but diaper prices have remained high, right? So what's going on here? And to your point, the executives at Kimberly-Clark and Procter & Gamble are not hiding the ball. P&G CFO said on their October 2023 earnings call that high prices were a big driver of the reason that they could expand their profit margins, and that 33% of their profits in the previous quarter were driven by lower input costs. And during their July 2023 earnings call, the company predicted $800 million in windfall profits because of declining input costs. Same thing on the other side, on Kimberly-Clark's side, right? Their CEO said in October that the company, quote, finally saw inflection in the cost environment, quote, end quote. And he admitted that he believes the company has, quote, a lot of opportunity to expand margins over time, despite what they're doing on the revenue side and also on the cost side. So despite large input cost decline, the CEO thinks that the company has priced appropriately and didn't anticipate any price deflation. So diapers, I think, is a really clear example of how these big corporations are exercising their corporate power in a moment where things are a little murky for consumers, right? We don't know necessarily, we don't have all the data at our fingertips or the time, frankly, to figure out, is the box of diapers more expensive for sensible reasons or not, right? And these big companies are taking advantage of both the information asymmetry and the particular inflationary environment we're living in.
And you don't have a choice. You've got to buy the diapers, you know?
Like, absolutely.
You can try to puzzle out why it costs more than it cost, you know, a year ago or 6 months ago, but you still have to buy them. And that's the thing. And I want to draw you out on something, because I see articles. It's not that media are not ever saying greedflation, or that they're completely ignoring the idea that corporations might be keeping prices high to profit, although it's still not shaping the dialogue in the way that you would hope. But I do see articles that put corporate profiteering in scare quotes, as if it's not a real thing. It's just an accusation. And I wonder, what do we call profiteering, and how does it differ from capitalism doing its capitalism thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a question that I've gotten over the years as we've done this work. It is not necessarily a bad thing for companies to be making a profit. You know, that's okay. Like, companies exist to make a profit. What we're talking about here is really profits above and beyond what they should be making.
Mm-hmm.
Excess profits, windfall profits, right? And companies making these profits on the backs of consumers.
Right.
The example that I always go back to is just the classic sort of price gouging example, right? If you are in the middle of a hurricane or a disaster relief situation, and you are a person who sells bottles of water or gallon jugs of water, if you jack the prices up because you know that people are going to need that water because there's no safe tap water to drink, that's price gouging and that is illegal. And yet, that happens across our economy all the time. And we've seen that in particular over the last couple of years as we've experienced the pandemic and have gone through these series of crises. And yet, we don't point it out, right? And I think part of the reason this idea is not taken seriously, I think there's a couple of reasons. The first is that it doesn't accord with the traditional story of where inflation comes from. The traditional story of where inflation comes from is workers are super greedy. They're asking for higher wages. And so we end up with higher wages, which push up prices, which force people to ask for higher wages. And you end up with what economists call a wage price spiral. The other sort of factor in the sort of traditional story about where inflation comes from is too much public investment flooding the economy is just going to jack up prices. And the reality of the situation is that wasn't the case here, right? We have seen historic public investment and inflation's come down. We have seen a strong labor market. You know, we haven't had to put millions of people out of work in order to bring prices down. And so the textbook story of how inflation works is not really holding water in the moment. It's not according with literally the reality that we're seeing in the data. And the truth of the matter is there are vested interests for folk to want to vilify workers, to want to vilify big public investments, right? And to continue to perpetuate an environment where big corporations can hold power and hold money and earn windfall profits on the backs of consumers. So I think it's really important to know that this is a narrative that's mute, and it's a narrative that is challenging sort of dominant stories about how inflation works. But the reason it has made a toehold, and I think more than a toehold at this point, and even the Wall Street Journal in December had a headline that said, outsized profits help drive inflation, now consumers are pushing back. The reason it sort of gotten its feet on the ground is because the experience of people across the economy, right? Like, this is exactly how people are experiencing the economy. And it's the truth of the matter. And I think that is really what certainly my work is always trying to do, is like, let's get to how people are experiencing the economy and speak to their concerns, because people know what's up. You don't need to tell them that big companies are exploiting them. They are very willing to believe it because it's how they've interacted with the economy for years.
Well, I have to say, you know, the idea that there's a abstraction that I'm supposed to pay obeisance to, and it's going to keep wages down and public investment down, you know, but somehow I'm still supposed to be for it, is kind of strange to me. The idea that I'm supposed to be so opposed to inflation that I'm supposed to be against higher wages for workers and I'm supposed to be against more public investment, it just shows how far we've gone in fealty to an abstraction, essentially, in terms of economic understanding. I find it very odd to have folks saying, oh, I don't want upward pressure on wages because somehow that's going to be bad for me ultimately down the road. It seems to me a kind of distortion of our understanding of the way an economy should work and who it should serve.
Right. I mean, we are the economy. That's kind of what we're always saying at Groundwork, that we are the people, the regular people are the people who are the economy. And it's our well-being that reflects whether the economy is doing well. And I also think it's important in conversations about inflation. I think we pay attention to prices and cost of living and affordability in a moment of crisis.
Right.
But the truth of the matter is that the high prices that people have been feeling, you know, in their household budget long predate this particular inflationary moment, right? The cost of childcare, the cost of healthcare, the cost of housing, the cost of education. I mean, all of these things go beyond what we're experiencing in this particular moment. They have been burdens on people for decades.
That was Rakeen Mahboud of Groundwork Collaborative speaking with Counterspin a few months back. Mifepristone has been in use for more than 20 years, but anti-choice zealots have added a tax on it to their long-term goals, despite the American Medical Association, for example, saying that that effort, quote, flies in the face of science and evidence and threatens to upend access to a safe and effective drug, close quote. When we spoke with Rachel K. Jones, research scientist at Guttmacher Institute, we asked first about the impact of the introduction of medication abortion.
So we know from decades of medical research that mifepristone is safe, effective, and widely accepted by both patients and providers. And Guttmacher's own research has established that the majority of abortions are done with medication abortions, 53% in 2020.
So what would we expect, I mean, immediately and then maybe longer term, if this effort to make mifepristone unavailable, if that were to actually go through, what sort of impacts would you be expecting?
Okay, so there's actually a lot that we don't know about what's going to happen or what would happen if the Supreme Court were to impose restrictions on mifepristone. But again, it's important to recognize that any restrictions that are put in place are not based on medical science. We do know that it would have a devastating, any restrictions that were put in place would have a devastating impact on abortion access. Again, 53% of abortions are medication abortions. Currently, 55% of women in the U.S. only 55% of women in the U.S. live in a county that has an abortion provider. And if mifepristone were taken away, that number would drop to 51%. But it would have a big impact. There are 10 states that would have a substantially larger, notable impact. So about 40% of clinics in the U.S. only offer medication abortion. And so, again, there's 10 states where if this was taken, if these clinics were taken away, if these providers were taken away, that substantially large proportions of people would no longer have access to abortion. And some of these are states that are actually supportive of abortion rights, states like Colorado, Washington, New Mexico. And again, just one example, in Colorado, it's currently the case that 82% of women living in Colorado live in a county that has an abortion provider. If mifepristone were no longer available, this number would drop to 56%.
I think it's important the way that Guttmacher links health and rights, you know, and the way that your work shows that access, sometimes media presented as though we're talking about the United States and rights to access to abortion in the United States, but it varies very much, as you're just indicating, by region, by state, and then also by socioeconomic status. So there are a number of things to consider here in terms of this potential impact, yeah?
Definitely. Again, we know from decades of Guttmacher research on people who have abortions that it's people in disadvantaged populations, low-income populations, people of color, who access abortion at higher rates than other groups. And so by default, any restriction on abortion, whether it's a complete ban, a gestational ban, a ban on a certain type of method, on a medication abortion, it's going to disproportionately impact these groups that are already, again, at a disadvantage.
Well, and I think particularly when we're talking about medication abortion, you know, if you know, you know. If you never thought about it, then maybe you never thought about it. But there's a difference between having to go to a clinic where maybe you're going to go through a phalanx of, you know, red-faced people screaming at you, and
right,
the ability to access that care in other ways. It's an important distinction, yeah?
Definitely. You know, one of the benefits of medication abortion of mifepristone is that it can be offered via telemedicine. You know, if there's a consultation, it can be done online or over the phone, and then the drugs can be mailed to somebody. There are online pharmacies that can provide medication abortion. This means that people, right, don't have to travel to a clinic, that they don't have to, in some cases, travel hundreds of miles to get to a clinic, that they don't have to worry about childcare and taking off time from work. So, again, medication abortion has the ability to, and has for a number of people, made abortion more accessible.
Well, if you talk to staunch anti-abortion people, the conversation is very rarely about science or about medicine, you know. But then some of them and their media folks will throw around terms that sort of suggest that they're being science-y. You know, they'll talk about viability or heartbeat, or they'll say it's about concern about the safety of drugs. And I just wonder, as a scientist who actually is immersed in this stuff, what do you make of the reporting on the medical reality of abortion? And would more knowledge help inform the broader conversation, or is it just two kind of different conversations? What do you think?
Right. I definitely think it's two different conversations. Like I said, we have decades of scientific medical research establishing that medication abortion is safe, effective, and widely accepted. People who don't support abortion choose to ignore the science and the safety and dig for their own factoids and supposed scientific facts to support their arguments.
It's so strange how the media debate always seems to start again and again at point zero, you know, as though there were no facts in the matter or
right,
no experience, and as though women aren't experts on their own experience, you know.
Right.
Well, finally, we see things like the Women's Health Protection Act, you know, federalizing the right to abortion. I know the law is not necessarily your purview, but in terms of responding to these court moves and these state level moves, do you think that federal action is the way to go?
Certainly, that is one solution, right? The Women's Health Protection Act would enshrine the right to abortion federally. But we also need, and especially in the current environment, I don't want to say Women's Health Protection Act is pie in the sky, but given everything that's going on right now, we also need federal and state policymakers to step up to restore, protect, and expand access to abortion. A lot of these restrictions are imposed. I mean, quite frankly, you know, the right to abortion was removed because of Roe, and that allows states to impose pretty much any restriction that they want to. We're seeing from all these different laws that are being implemented. And so it really is a lot of times at the state level, and certainly in the current environment, the state level is what we might need to focus on.
And then anything you would like to see more of or less of from journalism in this regard?
You know, on medication abortion, it seems like the media is actually doing a decent job of covering the issue, of acknowledging, again, the decades of research showing that medication abortion is safe, effective, and commonly used. I guess the only issue we might have is one that you see anytime that abortion is the subject of media stories, and that is a lot of times reporters think, well, if they have to take a fair and balanced approach, that means that they have to talk to the people who oppose abortion. And again, when this is about science and facts and research, then you don't need to talk to people who don't believe in it, don't believe in sound science, or who are going to ignore, again, decades of solid medical research.
That was Rachel K. Jones, principal research scientist at Guttmacher Institute. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find all of that on our website, FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.